Okay. Welcome to WPM Writing, Publishing, and Marketing, brought to you by Mott Publishing and WSCA Community Radio. This is the sixth in the series. We do it every month on the second Tuesday of the month at the WSCA studios in Portsmouth. And each month we have three authors, one talking about writing, one talking about publishing, and one talking about marketing. Each does a 10-minute presentation, and then we open it up for questions. I would ask you to save your questions until the three presentations are over so we can move along quickly. And after the question and answer, we have refreshments provided by the local merchants. I'm going to talk a little bit about what this series is. My name is Steve Carter, and I'm co-owner of Mott Publishing with my wife, Marilyn Carter. About 5 years ago, Marilyn wrote a cookbook, and she wanted music to go with the cookbook, so I composed two CDs of original music to go with the cookbook, and we had to find a publisher get it out quickly, so we wanted a publisher who could get it out quickly and who could include the CDs with the book. So we went with the publisher and we did the first edition of the book, and a while later we wanted to do a second edition of the book, and we weren't happy with that publisher, so we decided to start our own publishing company. Since then we've published a few books, and we help people to self-publish their books, and that's how Mott Publishing came about. Marilyn and I have been very active in the writers' community in the Seacoast, and there is a great writers' community here. There are writers' groups, there are open mics, there are poetry readings, there are all kinds of opportunities for writers. But what we wanted to do was to offer a series that very quickly went from the beginning to the end of the writing process, right from the time you get the concept for your book, through the writing, the publishing, and then to the point where you have the book in your hand and you're trying to convince somebody to buy the book. So that's where WPM came from. So we're going to start tonight. Tonight we have two authors. Shelby June has published a novel called Lost and Found. Her second book, Patchwork, a Collection of Short Stories, will be published very soon by Mott Publishing. Alex Case is an author and recording engineer, associate professor of sound recording technology at UMass Lowell. He has published two books with Focus Press, Mix Smart, Pro Audio Tips for Your Multitrack Mix, and Sound FX, Unlocking the Creative Potential of Recording Studio Effects. Appropriate, here we are in a recording studio. So we're going to begin with Shelby, and she's going to talk about writing.
Hi, again, my name is Shelby June. I've been a published author since 2015. My first book, Lost and Found, is a historical fiction. It is actually the result of a writing assignment in a writing class. Our first assignment was to write the first 5 pages of a book you've always wanted to write, which is the first 5 pages of Lost and Found, actually. I became interested in the Holocaust when I was about 10 years old, when I would watch documentaries on TV with my father, not really understanding what I was seeing, but completely infatuated with it, not in a good way. I was very curious as to how people could treat people that way and actually get away with it. So I knew if I were to ever write a book to honor those people, I really wanted to write a book about a Holocaust survivor written in present day, and her story and her secrets and her reunions with family and the secrets coming out. That book took me 2.5 years to write, and after that it was published through Piscataqua Press here in Portsmouth. I then started my short story book, Patchwork, and that book includes 22 short stories of very heavy, deep subjects. So to take a break from that, I started a children's series about my dog, Isabel, and her journey from Tennessee to New Hampshire. My writing process itself, my favorite part is character development. I love bringing the characters to life, giving them personalities, and they really take on lives of their own, which is really interesting. Lost and Found was completely different. The characters led me in a completely different way, which was really interesting and exciting also. I do my best writing probably in the middle of the night, literally, and also during vacation on cruise ships. I'll be the geek in the lobby with the laptop. My love of writing really naturally revolved from my love of reading, which I get from my father. He also taught me the love of music. My writing is very music influenced. A character in Lost and Found was developed by Empty Tables from Les Mis. The hardest part of writing is to market your finished product. It's to get people to read your stuff. But when you're very passionate about it, somewhat a shy person, I'm anxious to do events to show my work because Lost and Found is really my baby and I want it out there and people to read it. And that's true of all my books. I'm not sure how well Patchwork will be received because it is quite a dark book, but it's interesting subjects, important subjects of really timely subjects. So hopefully we'll learn a little more about the marketing. Maybe I can get a little help when Steve does his portion of the presentation. I'm going to turn it over to Alex.
Thank you. Steve neglected to mention my greatest achievement, which is I've recorded Steve as a recording engineer. I think on a porch in a bedroom and, well, it's starting to sound like a Dr. Seuss book. But that was always a real pleasure. It's my hope that my specific path to the books I've published is generally helpful, but it might be too specific to my field, so I'll hope to extend it. My books are about signal processing in the recording studio, and I saw a market need for the content, the educational content, long ago, and am a professor in that field, and so I was able to develop the content because they were part of lectures. And so every chapter in the book has behind it a 3 or 6 hour lecture that has sort of been road tested because I would teach it in various schools and give presentations at conventions. So an interesting path that I don't know that is available to fiction writers is that there are conventions in my field where I'm asked to speak, which is a great way to make writing easier later, but it also helps market the book as well. So I had been doing that for a while and was invited to write a monthly column for an audio-related magazine. And that forced me to write, at that time, 3,000-word articles every month, which I did for over 2 years. And I think that's where I learned my writing discipline, making sure I hit those deadlines. But anyway, so I had this content, and I would go to conventions and so on. And in my field, it was very clear who the right publisher would be. It's not necessarily a publisher you would know, but Focal Press is sort of the premier badge on books related to media and media technologies. So I made my way to meeting those people in person at a convention in New York, and we talked, and they invited me to propose and sent me a proposal form and so on. And ultimately what happened was I couldn't quite figure out I knew my message was unique, but I didn't know how to make the book unique. There are books on recording, there are books on mixing, so certain aspects of how sound recordings are created. So I had a mild epiphany, which was I'll make my book on effects, I'll make it on signal processing, which applies to both recording and mixing, and was totally unique, at least at that time. So I knew that could get the publisher's attention. The publisher ultimately is Elsevier Science, and the office that ran Focal Press at that time was in Oxford, England. So the way I ultimately got the book deal was working very hard on the proposal that they have a standard form for a textbook-like proposal, which includes a sample chapter and a full table of contents and so on. And I shipped the proposal about 24 hours before I boarded a plane, and I was traveling to Africa. And the easiest way to get to Africa, as we all know, is you fly to London overnight in an uncomfortable plane, and you get there, and then you have to wait a day before you fly overnight the 9 hours south from London to Africa. Obviously, this isn't the only way to go, but this is the way our frequent flyer miles were working. So I had about 12 hours in the UK, and so I made an appointment. And instead of sleeping in a hotel to deal with jet lag, I got on a bus so that I could take a train and have lunch with the woman who would become my editor. So I think that helped get the deal because it showed so much commitment. And being able to present your idea in person and to transform their standard form into something that also shows your passion for the subject and your ability to talk about it, I think helped. So it's an absurd story that I was able to merge a big vacation with a visit to the editor. But I think that really helped. And the second book is sort of followed from that. And I know you're recording this, so I'll be careful how I say this. I'm supposed to be working on the second edition of the first book. It's very much in mind. But the other thing that might be of interest is to know that very much because of the books that came from speaking at conventions and in classrooms and you know, sharing your point about being passionate about marketing your book in person, that was effective enough to get the attention of a publisher of online content. There's a company called Lynda.com, Lynda with a Y.com, that was born in online training for computer software. But at that time, they were just starting, they knew that to learn Photoshop or something like that, it was not fun to read a manual. So Lynda herself would record herself teaching you how to use Photoshop, and so it became a multimedia manual. The idea took off. And they next branched into photography, and they found a world of photographers interested in knowing more about photography. And that was very successful. So then they added an audio channel, and basically a friend of a friend called me and said, would you do a couple of online training? So they're essentially multimedia textbooks. But it all came from their knowledge of me in person as I talked about the same content that was in the print books. So that's kind of the journey. I'm supported by the sort of academic infrastructure of teaching that forces you to talk about it and learn about it, and conventions and conferences that force you to talk about it and actually debate with colleagues about it and so on. So that's kind of how my publishing came about.
All right, thank you. I know I'm going to have questions, but let me just do my marketing spiel here. You know, we've been running this for 6 months, and usually I sit in the publishing chair because there are not a lot of publishers around here. But last time we had Jeff Deck, who has been published by Random House and is also self-published. So we pretty much run the gamut from the smallest of small publishers to the big ones. And so when Alex agreed to do this, I was thrilled to sit on the same stage with him, decided to do the marketing piece myself, and I had never prepared a marketing presentation, but for the past 5 years, that's pretty much all I've been doing is marketing. So I'm going to talk about three phases of marketing: before you release your book, at the release of the book, and after the release. So before you release the book, you should begin getting your marketing materials together. You should write a press release. Even if you're only halfway through your book, write a press release, because it's going to need a lot of revision, just like your book will need revision. How do you write a press release? Well, you can look some things up online. The best lesson for me was after we published the book, the librarian, we did an event in at the Dover Public Library, and the librarian wrote a press release and had it published in the local paper, and it was really well done. So ever since then, we just take it and rework it slightly and keep reusing the same thing. You should prepare blurbs about your book, and I'll talk about this more later. But on the back of the book, you're going to have a blurb describing your book. What we found for different marketing channels is that they want different lengths. Some want 15 words, some want 30 words. So we have a series of blurbs, 15 words, 30 words, 50 words, and 100 words. So depending on where we're sending the marketing piece, we can provide the most essential information and then supplement it. Make handouts for your book events, like you'll see on the table over here. Things like the obvious things like bookmarks with the picture of your book on them, business cards, a schedule of your upcoming events, And ta-da, a sign. This is the world premiere of our sign, which we commissioned as a local artist named Aaron Stanley, who we admired his work, and we asked him if he would make a sign for us. We do lots of book events. We've done hundreds in the past 5 years. And when you're at a book event with sometimes 100 authors, it's easy to get lost. And so you have to have something to bring people to your table. Some people put out candy. Some people have big, very colorful signs. So we wanted something completely unique and commissioned Aaron to make that. We just picked it up and we're thrilled with it. And it also supports another local artist, and that's something I'm going to come back to later, is working with other artists. Before you finish your book, whether it's poetry or fiction, you should read an excerpt at an open mic. If you're a writer and you're not going to open mics, you should start doing that. And unless you happen to be the son-in-law of the owner of Random House or something like that, you know, and you've got a shoe in, you need to start making contacts right away. You should have an elevator speech. You've probably heard that phrase before. Something you could tell to somebody between the first floor and the third floor while you're on the elevator. It needs to be that quick. And I think just like your blurbs, you should have different lengths of elevator pitches. You should have a one-story elevator pitch and a five-story elevator pitch and all the way to the top of the Prudential elevator pitch, depending on how much time you have, what the situation is, what the feel is of the person who's listening. Where do you give that elevator pitch? Well, I give it at bars. I often, when Marilyn's working someplace, I'll usually drop her off and then I'll go to a bar while she works. And I have a little portable keyboard, a little folding keyboard, and my phone on a little plastic stand, and I sit there typing. And invariably, I usually sit at the bar because I know that the barmaid is going to say, "What are you writing?" And so that gives me a chance to give my elevator's pitch, hand her a business card and say, you know, keep an eye out, the book is going to be out someday. I will give you an aside that I've been working on this book for 45 years, but it will be out someday. You can give your elevator pitch at the New Hampshire Writers Project Writers Night Out. I really want to plug that because it's a great organization. Many of the authors that we've had in this series are members of that organization. And the first Monday of every month, they have what's called a Writers Night Out in Portsmouth. That's at the Book and Bar. It's in Manchester, Concord, Epping, and several other places around the state. And it's just authors getting together. It's not really a writer's workshop. There's not critiques. There's not, you don't read from your work usually, although once in a while somebody does. But generally you get a minute or two to stand up and say, "Hi, I'm Steve, and I'm working on a novel," and then you give your elevator pitch. And of course, that means you have to rehearse. So you go to the bar first, and you know, you practice on the bar, giving it to the barmaid. You know, build your chops up that way. You should join groups related to one of the topics of your book. And Alex really hit the nail on the head with that one, because he was past president of the
Audio Engineering Society.
Thank you. My book, my novel that I'm writing, it takes place in Boston in 1969. Most of it is underground in the Boston subway. And so I joined an organization called the Boston Street Railway Association because I wanted information about the Boston subway, especially in the era of the book, 1969. For example, I knew that there was an information booth in Park Street Station because a friend of mine used to work there. Actually, a musician, a band leader of mine, that was his day job, handing out information at the Park Street Station. And I remembered that it was there, but it's been gone for a long time. And people started saying, "No, there was never any such thing." So I contacted the Boston Street Railway Association, and sure enough, the president sent me 2 pages of information and historic photographs of that information booth. I also remember that there was a flower booth in the Boston and Park Street Station, and people said, "Oh, you're crazy. There was never a flower." Well, I found a picture of that flower booth. So joining these organizations helps you research, but we're going to come back to it and show another way that it helps also. One of my characters, whose name is Wednesday Jones, I have to digress and talk about where the name came from. Our daughter, Wendy Carter, started getting junk mail addressed to Wednesday Jones. So I said, well, I can't let that name go. I have to use that. So I'm copywriting that name. Don't anybody steal it. And I have it. When you read the book, you'll see how she got the name Wednesday Jones. But she grew up in my novel. Her mother was the librarian at the Boston Athenaeum and was descended from a man named Shaw, who was the first librarian of the Athenaeum back in the 1800s. I needed a way for my character to get some information about the Boston subway. Well, what better place than the Boston Athenaeum? They have all the information there. So I'm going to come back to talking about the Athenaeum when we talk about after release. Okay, so now you have your book release party. You should host the book release party yourself, and where you host it can vary. For example, we have one of our previous panelists with us here tonight, Beth Boynton, who published a book recently, and we hosted her book release party at our house and invited other authors as well as our friends and family and so forth. Shelby was there, and we had some of the authors read. I tried to get them to stand up on our little mini tramp and use it as a stage, but nobody wanted to do that. So you can have it at your house, you can invite people, or if you know somebody who has a big house, you can try to convince them to do it. We have an author that we published named Michelle Lowry, and she wrote a book about her dogs. And so her book release party was at the Club Canine Dog Wash and Spa. Perfect. So after you release your book, you should give a presentation for a group related to the book's topic. Well, Alex did that before and probably after. You're probably still doing presentations related to your books. So what I'm going to do is, once my book is finished, offer to do a presentation for the Boston Street Railway Association and talk about my research and talk about how I incorporated it into the book. There's the Seacoast Trolley Museum somewhere around here. I forget what town it's in. But they have all these antique subway cars, and there are a lot of train buffs who would be interested in the history that's in my book. So we went there one day. Alan and I went there one day when they were having an open house, and I wanted to see what it was like and research the trolley cars. And there was an author there doing a book event. And it was a murder mystery, but it had something to do with the Boston subway. So once you have your book, you need to market it in a lot of places. And you really need to think creatively about, where can I go besides library and bookstores? Those are the obvious. But there are a lot of other possibilities, depending on what's in your book. Once again, once you have your book, go back to the New Hampshire Writers Project Writers Night Out, and this time you can stand up and say, I now have my book, and then give your elevator pitch. And you might find people who want to buy it. But more important, you need to network with people in your field. Writing is a solitary affair, and too many writers write their book and then don't let the world know that it's there. So right from the beginning, you've got to be doing what you're doing to the people who are here tonight, getting out and meeting people and shaking hands and talking to people. And for the people who are listening to this podcast, they're doing the research, they're hearing the names, they're hearing the venues, they're hearing the ideas. You need to do that. The more personal interaction you get, the better. You'll notice, for example, that I've hardly talked about online marketing, about social media. There's plenty of information about that. We've had many good presenters here in the series, and it's important to do, but I think most people tend to forget that the best kind of marketing is word-of-mouth marketing. To get more exposure, you can ask to be interviewed once your book is released. Ask to be interviewed by your local paper. Don't wait for them to contact you. Don't wait for the New York Times to call you up and ask you if they can interview you. Find out, for example, we live in Dover, New Hampshire, and there's a guy named Ron Cole who's been writing for the local newspaper for years, and he has interviewed me in the past for music. And so as my book release gets closer, I'm going to try to get him to do a pre-release interview, and then once the book is out, post-release interview. Go to the town where your book is set, Boston for me, because my book is set in Boston, and try to get interviews there. I don't think I'll go to the Boston Globe, but there are probably little newspapers that that might do an interview. Ask to be interviewed by a local radio or TV host. Here at WSCA Radio, Pauline Hawkins has a show called All In, and she interviews various types of creative artists. So once again, the name is Pauline Hawkins. It's on WSCA Radio. Look it up. Send her an email and tell her who you are. Whether your book is finished or not, get the contacts going and see if you can come in. And then also local TV, cable TV. We were on a show called Right Now with Gail Haney. She's an excellent interviewer. I think she's in Haverhill. And we went in to do one session about the cookbook, and they videotaped it, and we finished, and she said, "That was great, let's do another one." Okay, and she went and changed her clothes. You know, she had a different set of clothes then. We had the same clothes on, you know, supposedly, a month later. She was great. And then we did one with Be My Guest with Jen Lewis in Upton. And Jen is a very interesting person, and I have no idea what the interview was all about. Okay, so that's my presentation. I do want to mention that I've known Alex for many, many years. He's a student of mine at Berklee College of Music, and I've had the good fortune to watch his career blossom. Through him, I've met a lot of very, very interesting people. So I think Alex is a living example of why having good relationships with the people you study with, you work with, is so beneficial, not just in terms of your spirit, but in terms of your career, because people will do things for you that corporations won't, let's put it that way. I'd like to open it up for questions. Yes?
I'd like to know, this is directed towards Shelby, like a little bit about your process on researching historical fiction.
Excuse me. I'm going to repeat the question so the microphone picks it up. This is a question for Shelby about researching historical fiction.
I did a lot of reading, a lot of watching, and a lot of listening. I went to the Holocaust Museum in Washington. And I just picked up pieces along the way, but 95% of my book is from right up here. It's from my own mind. The historical part of Lost and Found is extremely accurate. There's a responsibility for a book like that to get it right, especially where so many people didn't survive. So it was really an honor for me to make sure my research was correct and thorough.
At this series, we like to have all of the authors respond to the questions, because then you get, I think it's good to direct a question towards someone and then the others will respond, so you get different viewpoints on the same thing. Alex, what about research in the academic field, other than what you've already told us, which is massive?
it's the nominal role of a title that's about education, that you obviously have to know the field that you're educating about, and so that's my day job. I'm a professor. But I guess the thing I would add is that I had a real point of view for what the market might need. So my background, I'm an audio engineer now, but my first degree is in just traditional mechanical engineering. I was into robotics for NASA. And so I learned engineering in a sort of traditional way. And then when I went to audio engineering, I found a totally different way of looking at the science and the art associated with sound recording. And then I found that I have a point of view, which is I could bring traditional engineering discipline to a field that doesn't have it. And so that was a lot of my process of, I would understand the science and the art associated with creating sound recordings and then try to push it back to a traditional discipline. So my research was a lot of just sort of doing my own educating myself how to be an audio engineer, studying at Berklee, being a living practitioner, full-time recording engineer for about a decade. But in the back of my mind was always churning, there's a different way to present this information. There's a different way to think about this information. So I had to know the field, I had to do the research, but I was trying to reprocess it it's sort of hard. I don't want to bore you guys. I don't want to get too specific. So I'm not sure this has meaning when I describe that.
I think it does. I think one of the things that authors learn is that as they get more experience, they learn that they can learn from everybody, that to the artist, nothing is useless. You can find a way to translate things from their language into yours. When I was teaching at Berkeley, I taught English classes as well as guitar lessons. And so I would use music to teach English and English to teach music. So I think one of the things I've enjoyed about this series and the variety of authors we've had is that I've heard so many different perspectives. I wanted to mention something about historical research too. I went to a lecture at one of the Writers Project Writers Day events, and the woman presented about, her name is slipping my mind right now, Mourner's Bench is the name of the book, and I can't think of the author's name. Do you remember? No. But she did a very good presentation, and it's about a town down south and integration and, you know, racism and things like that. And so the title of her presentation was Location as Character. And I thought that's a fascinating idea. So I went to her presentation, and she talked about all of the research that she did on this town, where the buildings were and where the roads were and what the plumbing was and all the politics and blah, blah, blah. And then she said, but you don't want to put all of that in your book. It's in the background. It's in the back of your mind. And it adds a richness to your characters and to your description. Don't bore the reader with it. And when I read her book, I saw exactly what she was talking about. She would take a very minute detail, like the sound that the gravel made as the black girl walked barefoot out of her section of town, and then the lack of sound when she got to the richer part of town and her feet were falling on the blacktop. Little details like that make a real difference in writing. And that's a lesson I'm still trying to learn, because I've done so much research for my book on my novel. I actually brought a list with me because I thought it might be informative. I don't know. I might be boring people too. I don't know.
No chance.
No, I don't have it with me.
The list is 45 years long.
Right. But some of the things, like, it's 1969, my character Jim plays in a blues band. Most of this is actually, it's kind of like autobiographical fiction, the way I'm writing this novel. So he plays in a blues band. So there's the whole blues scene in Boston in 1969, Jay Giles and Van Morrison and all the people that I played with back then. And so there's all of that. It's 1969, there's a drug culture. So there's all of that kind of thing going on. It's in the Boston subway, so there's historical details about two men who were digging a trench and an opening went into the, an opening in the wall caved in, and one of the men went out into the Charles River, and, you know, all kinds of fascinating things, which I'm dying to put in the book, but I know I shouldn't. Because it's interesting to me doesn't mean it's interesting to the reader. My job as a writer is to, if I really want it in there, make it interesting to the reader. And that's why the book has taken 45 years. Other questions? Yes?
You sort of skipped over online, but I'm curious if there's anything particular online that you found useful, and how and where do you usually find and create podcasts?
Okay, good question. So the question, again, for the microphone is, since I kind of skipped over online, what is useful online, and how and where do you find podcasts? Podcasts have recently become a kind of fad. They've been around for years. It's kind of like the fax machine was around for years, and nobody used it, and then suddenly everybody had to have one, and then it went away. So right now, podcasts are popular. I tried listening to some writers' podcasts, and I just can't do it. I think most of them are just, frankly, I think they're just absolutely terrible, even when they have good people. I've listened to some of the writers that we've had in this series on other people's podcasts, and I like what those writers have to say, but the hosts, they drive me crazy. Everybody today is trying to be a hot ticket, you know, trying to be cool, trying to be funny, trying to be hip. So for myself, I really can't listen to podcasts. There isn't a single one that I would say, this is a good podcast. However, I did listen to a lot of podcasts, so I did the research, and there's a site called Podomatic, And that's one of the places where this podcast is. Some people may be listening to this right now on Podomatic. And you can simply submit your podcast there, and they will get it onto iTunes, and they will give you a link, and then you can use that link, and you can go on your Facebook page, and you can say, my newest podcast is now available, and you put the link there. And you can even copy the iTunes link and put that there. And so you can say, it's available on my website, here's the link. It's available on Podomatic, here's the link. It's available on iTunes, here's the link. And there are a bunch more. I was talking to somebody the other night who was advising me to get it on more sites, and I'm not sure that it's worth the effort, quite honestly, to get it on more sites. But we haven't been doing this for 6 months, so I don't know. You absolutely have to have, you have to have a Facebook page, you have to have a Twitter account, and you have to be visible. The thing that I've heard other publishers say is the problem today is that everybody's writing and nobody's reading. So when you go on social media, you have to read and not just write. You have to read other people's. So the BSRA has a site on Facebook, has a group on Facebook, so I joined them. The Boston Athenaeum has discussion groups, so I joined those. And you have to contribute. And that way you'll meet people and find people. Alex, do you use social media?
I do. Not with much fondness, but I do. I think it's necessary. I think your goal is to engage with people who are likely to have an interest in what you're writing. And so social media and blogs and podcasts are a way for people to get to know you in a way they can't just by looking at the back cover of the book and reading a blurb. It has to complement that. So I think it would be crazy to avoid them. You need to at least have your professional self out there. One thing that I do specifically is I have essentially a companion website that supports both of my books in print as well as all four of my online courses, and it's just my professional persona talking about sound recording. So the website is recordingology.com, the study of recording, and I just try to add new content to that, talking about a recent sound recording that has a good example of something from which you can learn if you're interested in this field. And it just gets steady traffic. It gets 2,000 unique visitors a month, every month. It has for a decade. It's never taken off. Nothing's gone wildly viral. But I can see book sales tick up every time I do an engaging post. So I think authors ought to think about what's the way to be your sincere self in this electronic format, not just a salesperson. Be your sincere self, but make yourself do that and do it often enough that people notice. And I have people who have come up to me and they first met me through that website and then they found the book, so it does work. Or I'll do a post on that and other people share it, and then other people find the book that I never would have reached out to. So I think a companion website is the harder effort. It's appropriate in my field. The easier way to do it is just do the social media, Facebook and Twitter. It's a necessary evil in this day and age.
Shelby, social media?
I use Facebook and Twitter, and I also have a website. I have a...
Which is?
ShelbyJuneBooks.com.
Thank you.
I have a few dedicated people who, when I post on Facebook, they share it, so I know the word's getting out there a little bit. But that's all I'm using for now.
But I noticed on your website that it says something like you're a furry friend, so I knew you were a dog lover or cat lover.
Definitely.
And I was hoping dog, yes. but it's little things like that that would never be appropriate necessarily in a book. It wouldn't come out in a presentation, but you get to reveal a little bit more of yourself through these other ways, and I think that attracts readers.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yes.
I'm familiar with what you're all saying. The one thing I've done is a boosted on Facebook, which I don't know, they say reaches a bunch more people, and definitely get whatever the count is of people that saw it goes up a lot.
Interesting you mentioned that. He's talking that the question is about boosting. On Facebook, for example, you pay a certain amount of money and it gets to more people. Marilyn, last month one of the guys talked about, was it Dan or Jeff? I think it was Dan, who was saying don't waste your time with boosting on Facebook. Dan Chesney was our guest last week, and he's been an author for many years and is one of the best marketers we've encountered. And I think it was him who was saying that he didn't think that was worthwhile. So everybody's got a different experience with it. It's really hard to gauge unless you have really good analytical software that tells you that, not just Amazon telling you that it reached this number of people, but as Alex said, your book sales went up and you can see a correlation. And sometimes it's just a fluke and book sales go up and you don't know why. So you can't always get a cause and effect relationship between a particular marketing plan and what happens over the next week or month or 6 months. That's one thing that marketers are good. Marketers are good at marketing, and they will tell you that we have this plan and we can guarantee you that we can tell you exactly what effect it's going to have on your sales. Well, I don't think they're telling the truth with that one. That's been my experience.
Someone did say you could, some way on Amazon, you could find out if a bunch of people bought your book that week or something, but I've never figured that one out.
Well, I've been on Amazon for 20 years. Alex recorded my first CD, thank you, Alex, 20 years ago. Wow. And I started Frog Story Records, and I got an account with what they call Amazon Advantage. And so I've been on Amazon for 20 years. I think that I've made, from my music sales, I think maybe I've made $100 in sales. And when we started, when we published our No Fret Cooking book, we went on Amazon, of course, and we got the book on there, and we got reports from Amazon. And for a while, we got reports from our publisher, who the way that it works is the publisher contacts Amazon, and Amazon requests a certain number of books. They don't like to keep too much in inventory, so they might buy 5 or 6 books. And then when Amazon requests another batch of books, every time the publisher ships a batch of books, they would send us a report and said, we sold this many books. Well, there was absolutely no correlation between what we saw on our Amazon reports and what we saw from our publisher. So, I mean, I've been very sour. That's one of the reasons we started my publishing. I've been very soured on Amazon because I've had a lot of experience with them. 20 years is a long time. So I'm probably overstating the case, but I would just caution people to be really careful of marketing plans, whether it comes, especially when it comes from the guy you're paying, you know, and you're paying Amazon. You know, they're taking a big chunk of your book. And so naturally they're gonna tell you that they're doing good stuff for you. So I would just say, just be careful. For myself, I would rather, when people ask where can they buy the book, we always say from our website, or we'll deliver it to your house, or here I have one. I carry a copy of my, I just started carrying a copy of my poetry book with me. So when I'm sitting there at the bar and the barmaid says, what are you writing? I say, and I also wrote this here. It's kind of like, and sometimes I'll give them away. It's just like a business card. It only costs a couple of dollars to print a little book of poetry. So I try to do all of the, I try to keep control of it myself, so I really know what's working and what's not working.
It seems the only final thing is that royalties will kind of tell you in the end, but in like a month bracket, so you don't know exact dates.
Yeah. Right.
One other little thing about this one, if any of you had experience with LinkedIn or Constant Contacts, using them?
I've been on LinkedIn for years and it's done absolutely nothing except annoy me. Have you, Alex?
I can, when I choose to try to engage with potential readers via LinkedIn, I'll sometimes see a blip in sales or clicks on my online courses. So it has been effective for me, but I think I have an advantage that fiction writers don't have, which is I'm in a very specific field and we all know each other. So I don't know what the lesson might be learned for you, except I'm really taken with what Steve's saying of connecting with the subway and train enthusiasts in Boston as part of creating this book. I think that's a really intriguing idea, because in my field, we almost all know each other. And so if I make a post that's particularly interesting to everyone who cares about the sound of reverb on a snare drum, it'll, for no good reason, it'll travel around all those people who also care about the reverb on a snare drum. And that's my audience. And the 2,000 people remaining who didn't buy the book, they're going to buy it in the next 5 years. They just don't know it yet. So I have the ability in LinkedIn and Facebook, because of how specific my market is, I have the ability to at least get their attention and pique their interest every now and then. And I would think you can do that if your book is really tied to a topic. You should think about how to get in front of those communities.
Shelby, do you use LinkedIn?
I used to, but like you, I was annoyed by it, so I don't really use it anymore.
And the reason for being annoyed would be with library?
I found that it just didn't do anything for me and what I was looking for, but I would get lots of emails from them about various things that I didn't really need or want.
Other questions?
Do you have something, I know when you presented it, do you have something written that says what to do before, like at the time it's going to be published? Do you have something actually written out that kind of gives some steps or things to be thinking about?
I'm going to post this outline that I was reading from,
Okay. And
hopefully I will try to elaborate on it a little bit more.
Okay.
That's one of the services we'd like to provide at Mott Publishing, is just get some scaled down information out there. When I was preparing this, I did research, I forget which site it was, Authors something or other. Anyway, they had 85 techniques you can use to market your book. That's too much. I mean, nobody's going to take the time to read that. So we're trying to boil. I tried to boil some of this down, and I will put it. Just go to mottpublishing.net, and there'll be a section there called resources or something like that.
And okay.
Put that out there. The other thing that we do is we have a what happens in self-publishing walkthrough, and so it's one page of a bunch of. You know, you have an interview and you submit your manuscript and then it's edited and then you do the revisions and then, you know, all the different steps in there. And I've boiled that down to one page, so I don't know if I put that up there yet. And then I have the expanded version that once we start working with an individual author, then we go through and we say, okay, so you submitted the manuscript on August 3rd and then Marilyn edited it and we sent it back to you on,
and
we can track the journey, and then we know who's responsible for what when, because sometimes you lose communication and the author doesn't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we make that mistake too, because we're just really just beginners at this. But yeah, that's a good question. There will be some resources on my site, and that's kind of one of my purposes. I've always wanted to take complex, like Alex does, he takes complex things and makes them as simple as they can be.
Sure.
So that's what I try to do. Although I did, you know, Alex had a nice little marketing routine that he did when the FX book came out, and he had his people who bought his book take a picture of it in the field, so to speak. So it might be on a coffee table, or it might be on a bar, or it might be whatever. So I was working through the first chapter of the book, which is a lot of mathematics, and I dug out a slide rule that I had from when I was in college and put the slide rule on top of the book, took a picture, and posted it up there. Mm-hmm. So that was my contribution. Other questions? Yes?
One of the things that I ran into that I didn't realize with this book, the last book I did recently, was that print on demand and the situation with that. Now, there's a lot of places like Barnes & Noble that don't stock your book if it's print on demand, but the reasons for that are kind of vague, because you can get the returnable policy from your publisher, so that the book is returnable from a bookstore. But print on demand, they make it sound like, oh, we've got to order a whole bunch to get it. And then it may, you know, I don't know, it's a little confusing that it would sit there on the shelf and they wouldn't sell it. I mean, if you ordered it, they'll get it for you. but they won't put it on the shelf because it's print on demand, and that's basically because it wasn't a big enough publisher to make it not just print on demand. So I don't know, wait and see the status and future of that. I've heard mixed reports from different bookstores.
We've never been able to get into Barnes & Noble. At one point, I guess it was a couple of years ago, we talked to them, and they had this long list of requirements. You know, you have to have had done radio shows, and this is before we had done any of these things, radio shows and TVs and press releases and all this stuff, because we were self-published. Or we weren't self-published at the time. We were published by a small small publisher who was basically what we are. They basically help people self-publish their books. In other words, we had to pay to have the books printed. We had to pay them to lay out the page and to lay out the cover and do all of that sort of thing. So it's basically what we're doing. But they didn't present themselves that way. They said, oh, we'll get you into Barnes & Nobles, and we'll get you into a Baker & Taylor, and you know, all of these things. And some of them they did, but it didn't sell any books. So Barnes & Noble has not been successful for us, and people I know who have gotten their books into Barnes & Noble, who are self-published, it's very hard to do, and they do manage to get events there. And, you know, I think it was Jeff who was saying, when you self-publish a book and you put it in Barnes & Noble, they put it what they call spine out. In other words, it's just another book in the line of books. But if you're Dan Brown, you get a table, and you get displays, and you get all this stuff. Well, people respond to those things. So even if my book is in a bookstore that I love, like Gibson's, it's in Gibson's in Concord. It's a wonderful bookstore. I'm glad to be there, and it's a privilege to be there with some of the other authors that are on the same shelf. But the spine of my book is probably not going to sell it. They haven't been calling me up and saying, please accept our check for all the books that we've sold. So now, obviously, I'm not fond of the big box stores. I'm not fond of Amazon and Barnes & Noble and so forth. So, you know, you really should talk to somebody who's self-published and managed to get their book in there. I don't know how they do it.
I'm not technically self-published because I went through Balboa Press. And they ship to Amazon, and Amazon actually creates their own book somehow when they get it. And it's a real complicated thing. I don't know how it works. But supposedly they'll produce it somehow.
Yeah, they may just be working through CreateSpace, which is the self-publishing arm of Amazon. And we know a lot of people who have published on CreateSpace. Some of the books are great, and some of them are not. The quality of the book itself is due to the authors preparing the right materials to send to them. We know one guy who would self-publish through CreateSpace, which might be what's happening with your book. And we were at a writer's meeting, and he was chatting with another very inexperienced author and talking about CreateSpace, and this guy said, well, you know, I sent my book off to CreateSpace, and then they sent it back and said it had to have page numbers. I didn't know it had to have page numbers. So I redid it, and I sent it in, and then they printed it. And so then I looked at his book, and I opened it up, and there's a title page, and it says 1. And then you turn to the copyright page, and it says 2. Not very professional. Yeah, I'll probably, you know, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and CreateSpace, they're probably all waiting for me outside the door. I'll be assassinated for this. Anybody else have any comments on that?
No? I guess the thing I would add is that with print-to-order, that's got to be terrifying for a brick-and-mortar store, right? If it's that easy for someone to get elsewhere, it's risky for them to put it in the store and own that inventory. So I think it's tough to be a big bookstore. I think they want the Dan Brown books that they know will sell. And for the independent publishers, they recognize you can kind of compete with them by selling it through your own avenues. So I imagine that's what motivates that policy that you're hearing about.
That's a good point. That makes sense, because if Amazon can sell it and the publisher can sell it, people can go direct to the publisher, and then bookstores are getting it. Different bookstores everywhere, as long as the return policy, although my return policy did expire because it was like $400 a year, and it seemed kind of ridiculous to pay for that.
But they lose, it's expensive for a bookstore to return a book.
Right.
The end. So yeah. That's not enough for them to view it as a wash, I don't think.
No, I understand that. It's just that, I'm always relying on people ordering the book somewhere. Mm-hmm. Because the cost of making the returnable isn't enough that the sales will compensate for that expense.
Right.
Yeah, just for the listeners at home, I want to clarify, we're talking about returnable books. And with most traditional publishers, the publisher has an agreement with the bookstore that if the books don't sell, the books come back to the publisher. From what I've heard, I've never been in this situation, but I've heard that there are some publishers who then take that out of the royalties that were advanced and say, now you owe me back for these books. So you might get a $10,000 advance, and then 6 months later your books didn't sell, and they say you owe us $9,000 because they returned $9,000 worth of books. I've heard people say that that's happened. That's probably just a few, fly-by-night places that do it.
I don't think in my...
The first publisher we went with didn't...
I haven't seen it happen yet.
Yeah, the first publisher we went with didn't... They had a return policy for the stores, and they never charged us back. I mean, we paid them up front. We paid to have the books printed, so it's a different thing. A lot of self-published authors will... Just to explain, because some of our listeners may not know, there are different levels of self-publishing. One, you can do everything yourself. You can write it, you can edit it, you can do the layout, you can paint the cover, you can prepare the print-ready PDF and send it off to CreateSpace, and then you pay X amount of dollars to have that book printed, and they send it to you. You can do, one book at a time. Then there's the way that we do it, which is you pay us to do the editing and the layout and the cover design and all that sort of thing, and we get it ready for the printer, we send it off to the printer, and then our printer has a $150 minimum. So if your book is only a little book of poetry, you might get 60 or 70 books or something like that for your $150. So that's the way that we do it. And then you have your box of books. The good thing is you don't have to buy 5,000 books, which you used to have to do years ago. When I made my first CD with Alex, just to get five boxes of CDs, three of which are still sitting in my closet, cost me $2,500 just to have them printed and shipped to me. And now, of course, you can just burn them in your home studio. So you can do a lot of it yourself. If you do it yourself, make sure that you have some good people to ask if you've done it right before you commit to it. Now, that was a bit of a digression, but I did want to talk about the different levels of self-publishing. There are different levels of self-publishing, just like they are. There are different levels of the, there's the big five, and then there's all the stuff. The big five is Random House and all of those. But then there's all these publishers in between that have wide varieties of policies and practices, so the author really has to be very, very cautious. We met one woman, wonderful woman, who had written a book, and I've told this story before in this series because I think it's important for people to hear. It's a wonderful book, but she paid thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars to have it edited and printed, and then she asked Marilyn to read the book. And Marilyn found, 54 typos and grammatical errors and so on and so forth. And so this woman then had to go and have the book re-edited and republished. So people can spend a lot of money on this stuff and not get a very good product. You have to be very careful. Other questions? Comments? Yes?
This is just from the field. In the category of books, do you know where the majority of purchases take place? Is it online versus retail? Do you have any idea? Or does that become subject specific? Do you know?
That I don't know. I mean, my impression is that, there's a reason why the owner of Amazon is one of the richest men in the world. So I think most of them are online. Does anybody have any stats?
People buy engagement rings and wedding rings online.
Yeah.
Isn't that amazing? Yeah.
Yeah.
from my clients, that was their biggest challenge, was online purchases. And you'd say, gee, you think you'd really want to see this. But yeah, that was his biggest competition, was online. That was many years ago.
Yeah.
Same thing with food, right? You know, the chocolate, the strawberries, yeah. Just curious.
I'm sure it's field or topic specific. I know that I sort of have two extremes. I'm in university bookstores, and the rest is online. So when the book first came out, it was in Barnes & Noble and such places. But now it's really rare. You have to have a big Barnes & Noble that has a whole aisle dedicated to media technologies, and then maybe my book will be one of the ones there. But it's so the way I get to most of my customers is online, with the exception of university bookstores.
So they already know of your work and they go looking for you, do you think?
That's the hope, yeah. So I think I've never been an impulse buy because someone saw it on the shelf. Mm-hmm. But through links and social media, certainly total strangers have bought the book that way. But that would be an electronic purchase. And the other thing is ebooks. My ebook sales are probably about almost a third and a growing proportion of my annual sales.
And that's low cost for you, right?
It's bizarre. It's no cost for me. Amazon charges the same price.
Right?
So I don't know who gets all the extra money, the publisher or Amazon.
I guess it's not
but the,
you.
I get the same price per title. Yes, that's very interesting. Yeah.
Shelby, you've done a lot of events with us, and you probably have some online sales and some in-person sales. Which do you find you have the most sales, online or in person?
In person, for sure. Lost and found, I've personally bought 300 copies to sell at events, and I know I've had a little bit of online sales with the ebook and with the actual physical book. But I've sold almost 300 of those that I bought at events, face-to-face, handing somebody a book. And that's good for me, because I enjoy handing them the book, telling them to enjoy it, telling them my father did the cover photo for me, giving them a little family history. It's just nice to make a connection with a person that way.
And I think of all the hundreds of authors that we know, I think most would agree that most of their sales, of course, we don't hang out with Dan Brown or, you know, J.K. Rowling, but most of the authors we know would agree that most of their sales are handing it, you know, in-person sales, and that's what they enjoy the most. I'm actually thinking of writing an article and posting it on our site, and I'd asked some of our authors if I could interview them and ask them about that, because I'm really curious if they will come forward, maybe not with hard numbers, but just to say what their experience has been online, what their experience has been in person. So I'm hoping to do that. I have several, maybe Shelby might want to be interviewed too, and put that online so people can get some answers from authors who have struggled to sell their books.
Yeah, I go to a lot of shows and people that say, well, I'll think about it. Then you think they go back and they decide later they'll go to Amazon.
Yeah.
But they might have seen it first. And when people see something first, they identify with it much more than if they don't see it.
Yeah.
So they know what they're getting. They look at, oh, this is big. But when the royalties come back, it's probably 50-50 Amazon versus other sources through the royalties, but then when I sell myself, because I buy back from the publisher so many, and then sell those at different shows, and I've sold way more than they have, that's for sure.
You've sold more than the publisher
yeah,
has.
Right.
Yeah. And that's been the case, and I think Alex's situation is different because he's going through it, of an academic, traditional publisher, but most either self-published people or people who've gone through smaller presses. And what I've heard so far is that they sell more themselves in person than online.
Can I loop back to your distinctions among self-publishing? Because I wanted to just elaborate on an author's perspective. So I'm lucky enough, because I'm an academic, not to be self-publishing. So I'm on, my publisher brags that they were also Galileo's publisher. So they've been around a while. So I didn't have to do copy editing. I didn't have to lay it out. I didn't have to know where the Roman numerals stop and the real numbers start and those things. So they provided those services. However, I cared a lot about the look and feel of the book. And so even though this publisher would have done everything, I wanted to control the graphics. There are a number of illustrations, I think 115 illustrations. And I commissioned those with working with a former student who's a great artist. So they cared most about designing the cover, and they actually wanted the cover done before I'd finished the first chapter. You know, once the book was greenlit, they wanted a cover that they could start to promote.
Yeah.
And the rest I was very involved in. And so as an author, I think you can't just be the writer. You have to think about the reader's experience. So I cared a lot about even the font is my decision, how they would lay out, where are the page numbers, and could there be a little bit of color here and there and so on. So I would encourage you to be the control freak you might need to be to make sure, even if you're not self-publishing, to make sure that the those letters on the page reflect the mood and feel that you want.
I have a good friend who's an editor. Like.
All my friends are my editors. I'm the son of an English teacher, and then a lot of friends read the book. And there's still typos.
Hmm. Yes.
I have one more question. I'm sorry, what was your name?
Shelby June.
I just wondered, when you were writing your novel, do you have a particular, you know, age in mind, who your target audience is? So I wonder whether young people, are they reading books?
Yes.
I can't read anything on length online. You know, I have to print it out. And I just wondered whether that, I loved books growing up. I can't imagine giving that up. And so I wonder in terms of demand, whether it does break out across age. You know,
let me repeat the question.
To have the book, you know, versus the electronic version.
Let me repeat the question for the microphone. And that is for Shelby, when you're writing your book, do you have the age of the reader in mind?
You know, do you have a target who you're talking to?
Lost and Found is targeted from middle school up, because the Holocaust is not taught in schools like it used to be. When a friend of mine, their son, asked me what my book was about, I said it was about the Holocaust. And he said, "Is that the flu?" And it broke my heart right there. So I really wanted to make it appropriate for middle school and up so they could take this story and learn a little bit about the Holocaust.
Yeah. We know another author who was a guest on this series, K.M. Doherty, and he writes for middle school kids, and he is one of the most successful local authors we know. He goes into schools and libraries, he does craft fairs, he does all kinds of things. You really should check out his website. I think it's kmdoherty.com, I'm not sure. Thomas Holland and the Prophecy of Elfhaven, I think, was his first book. And I've read them all. I've read the two books that he has out. They're great. And they're aimed at middle school kids, and kids are reading them, and they're excited about them. So that, to me, is great news. And,
yes.
You know, they're well-written books and very imaginative. So, yeah, I think the young people are reading. Honestly, I think that what bothers me is that adults are not reading. We've done hundreds of book events, and we'll see when there are customers. Sometimes there's, you know, 100 authors and 2 customers. But when there are customers, they come through, they look at the cover of the book, they turn it over for a second, and they decide just like that, and then they buy it. I've almost never seen anybody actually open the book and read a little bit of it. So I don't know whether they're decorating their walls with these books or what, but you wonder if they're actually reading. The first author in this that we had in this series was Tim Horvath, who's a wonderful writer, and we did a book event with him, and I went over and I opened his book and I read the first paragraph and I almost fell over. It was so good. I couldn't believe that I was standing next to somebody who could write like that. Mm-hmm. And it breaks my heart when people don't do that. They don't really examine the book that they're about to buy. It's got a cool cover and it's a murder mystery. Okay, we're done. I'm buying it.
So they look at the endorsements in the back? Is that
yeah, or the blurb, yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
Some don't even do that. They look at the cover, and that's it. Any other questions? Well, thank you very much. Let me just wrap it up with thanks to Alex Case and Shelby June for being our guests. Thanks to WSCA Community Radio for providing the facilities. And thanks to the local merchants for providing the refreshments. A special thanks to Marilyn Carter of No Fret Cooking, who tonight has made chocolate surprise cupcakes. Those of you who are listening to this on the podcast, you can just drool. But they're beautiful and they're delicious, and they're on page 78 of No Fret Cooking. You can get the recipe and make them for yourself. That's a little bit of marketing there. All right, thank you. Refreshments are served.